distance that they can travel, they can come at bases from any direction. In general, we could detect something and have 30 seconds to 2 minutes of heads up to either make a decision or get people in a bunker. You clearly want to shoot with your furthest weapon that can hit it down. You know, so as it gets closer and closer, you're using everything you can. It was almost like we were being hunted versus hunting.
Hey, welcome back to the Modern War Institute podcast, brought to you with the very generous support of the West Point Class of 1974. I'm John Amble, editorial director at MWI, and on this episode, I'm joined by Colonel Scott Wentz. He is the commander of 2nd Brigade Combat Team, 10th Mountain Division, a unit that recently returned from a 9-month deployment to the Middle East. And during that deployment, the brigade's units were targeted by more than 100 attacks by drones, one-way attack unmanned aircraft systems, to be specific. That means that the brigade has more experience defending against drones than any other unit in the Army. We discuss that experience in this episode, along with some of the lessons that we can draw from it. You'll also hear another voice on the podcast a few times. That's Major Anthony Padolino, who was responsible for overseeing base defense operations at Al Asad Air Base, one of 8 bases across Iraq and Syria where the brigade soldiers were located. It is an interesting and insightful conversation on a really important subject. But before we get to it, as always, a few quick notes. First, very special thanks to the West Point Class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. Second, be sure to subscribe to the MWI podcast on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. And finally, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Colonel Scott Wentz. Colonel Scott Wentz, welcome to the MWI podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you here, and I'm really excited about the conversation because we're going to talk about a very important topic, specifically defending against unmanned aircraft systems. And we're going to have that conversation based on your very recent and very relevant experience. You're the commander of 2nd Brigade Combat Team, 10th Mountain Division. Your brigade quite recently returned from a deployment in the Middle East where you did face a number of drone attacks. So we're going to talk about some of the lessons you learned from that experience. But to sort of set the stage, I wonder if you can kind of provide some context and share with listeners where you were, how long you were deployed, and what the mission was.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm very proud of the team, but of the 7 battalions, 4,500 soldiers in the brigade, we took about 60% of them forward. And so sorting through that, we had a 1 battalion down in Kuwait, and the other battalions were up split between Iraq and Syria and a little bit in Jordan. So we owned 8 bases across Iraq and Syria.
So you were pretty widely dispersed.
Absolutely. I mean, just the countries alone. But for instance, like if you think about eastern Syria, 1 battalion owned that. That's about the size of Massachusetts, to give you a kind of perspective.
Oh, wow.
And that's, separated into at least 4 bases there. And, you know, so that's when you do the math there, that's company commanders, out hundreds of miles in some cases away from the nearest American with assets that they've never seen and touched before.
Can you tell me about how many of these UAS attacks your brigade faced over the course of the deployment?
Absolutely. And as most people know, on open source, it started in mid-October. Mid-October is when they began, and then generally through February with a few breaks here and there. But when they did happen over that this month period, we had about 115, I might be off 1 or 2, one-way UAV attacks or drone attacks.
One-way UAV, one-way UAS, these are terms that have only really become pretty commonly used recently, and I think it's probably pretty self-explanatory, what that means. But from the perspective of somebody who has been on what was intended to be the receiving end of these attacks with these systems, can you maybe put a finer point on what we're talking about here?
Absolutely. So I think, and it's important, I think a lot of the things we talk about as we think about the future and things like that, it's very contextual, right? So backing up just a second from that is, we were on fixed site bases. That's where, you know, so the enemy knew where we were. We had to defend and we were static there. Contextually for the threat, those drones, like you mentioned, and I know there's a lot of different terminology for them, but what we use in particular is the unmanned aerial system is usually one controlled by, you know, somebody on the ground with the controller. And a UAV or unmanned aerial vehicle is one where it's, you know, the coordinates, the location is loaded in it, and it is flying there by itself. And of the 115, they were all one-way UAVs or a coordinate loaded in the system, and it was coming, which as we get into it, it makes it a lot more difficult to counter.
We're going to get into some of the hardware that you had on hand, the kinetic and non-kinetic systems, the sensors involved. But before we do, I'd like to maybe add a little color to the threat picture, both in terms of who was responsible for launching these 100-plus one-way UAS attacks at your forces, but also the technical kind of specifications of the systems involved, you know, their size, range, payload, things of that nature.
Yeah, and when I think of threat, backing up just a little bit from the drones, and then I'll dive into them. We also experienced ballistic missiles, right? We had hundreds of smaller missiles and rockets also. But those are traditional ones, or at least ones that historically we're familiar with. But, you know, we were over there. The OIR's mission is ensure the enduring defeat of ISIS. But who was shooting at us was not ISIS. And so to the credit of the leadership over there, that was still being accomplished while all this was going on. But when you look at the threat itself, I think the Iranian aligned militia groups are essentially who was targeting us. And that's a big conversation all in itself. But the drones they were shooting at us, you know, they of wide variety, usually group two and group three, which is how the Army categorizes the size, speed, and what they carry. But in general, right, they were launched from hundreds of kilometers or miles away from where they were going. They were anywhere from 100 feet and, you know, above the ground as they traveled towards us or when they came at us. They travel about 100 knots or miles per hour in general. And, you know, they carry anywhere from 10 to 20 kilograms or, you know, that's 20 to 40 pounds of explosives when it hits. And it's pretty, I mean, they're larger bombs, but these are precise. And so that packs a punch.
You mentioned the DoD categorization of these unmanned systems, right? The groups one through five. And it's something that comes up. This framework comes up often in articles that are submitted to MWI. So I was reading about it recently. And if you look back at when it emerged, this framework sort of emerged around 2010, 2011. And if you look at the documents, both DoD and Army documents, it was really about our UAS, right? Integrating the platforms in our inventory into U.S. military operations. And so on the low end, the group one, you've got things like at the time, the Ravens, man-portable fixed-wing systems. And on the high end, groups four and five, big fixed-wing aircraft like the Reapers and the Predators. But one thing all of those had in common was, you know, all of the drones that we employed, all the unmanned platforms that we employed are intended to come home. These one-way attack UAS that you face, they don't have landing gear. They're different, right? I was speaking recently to one of your battalion commanders, Max Ferguson, and the way he put it was that these UAS are intended to land on their nose with a bang.
That's right. That's their only plan they have. That's why they call it a one-way. It's coming. They're launched from like a launcher, and so it doesn't have any landing gear on it. It couldn't return home if it wanted to. It's programmed, and then, you know, there are things in there to make it hard to exploit, quite frankly, where it came from, even after if some didn't explode sometimes, occasionally, you know, things would go wrong so we could recover them. But even as we take the parts of them and try to sort through it, it's the distances that they come from make that extremely difficult to, you know, for a brigade coming from hundreds of miles away is where it launched from in any direction, right, anywhere. The distance that they can travel, they can come at bases from any direction, regardless of where it's launched, because they program the whole flight data in there.
I believe your deployment began in August of last year. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. August, we took over there.
Okay, so you took over in August. You said the bulk of these attacks happened between October and February.
That's correct.
Does that mean that, you know, when you went into the deployment, when you replaced the unit that preceded you there, was this part of your expectations that this would be a major feature of the threat landscape?
I'll answer that with, I don't get the luxury of being an optimist, right? So the four or so brigades before us, they did experience it one way, usually one or two the entire 9 months, right? So whether it's one or 100, we were pretty serious about getting ready. And it just so happens that the preparation did help out quite a bit. And so when we got over there from day one, you know, the Army has a way of distracting you from what's important. You know, like I remember on the trip over there, for instance, lots of movement in boats and ships, and I have a whole staff for that. So I had to sit down commanders and be like, look, we almost are like fighting ourselves sometimes and just our own bureaucracy getting over there. I'm like, hey, the commanders are going to look up and start looking at the enemy, right? And so well before the attacks came, and we had several other smaller priorities, but from the very beginning, you know, kind of temporally, it was tactical targeting. Let's find the people that are trying to shoot us before they shoot at us, and deal with that. And then if we failing that, they launch something at us, we knock it out of the air, which is the most important part for this conversation. And then there's a piece of hardening all our infrastructure, building bunkers the right size. So if we miss or something happens, that we keep people alive. And then if that fails, having a robust medical with a walking blood bank so we can keep people alive. And without question, from day one, and even before we left here, that was our focus. And if I can just add, like, I was able, the 10th Mountain right now and in the history has, you know, there's two brigades, 1st and 2nd Brigade at 10th Mountain up here at Fort Drum. One deploys over there. Brian Ducote deployed, you know, 18 months ago, then a National Guard unit, then 2nd Brigade, then 1st Brigade, then a National Guard unit. And so we kind of flip-flop. I was able to go visit him a while ago and come back and really think about where we're going and what we're doing. And that visit was critical to how we shaped our training path, and including focusing on the counter UAS, locking in crews like in the Army, like we do it for our armored forces. You know, like the brigade commander has to like approve any changes to the people. So you lock them in and you get them solid and you train them up. That way we're not just, we miss some of the turnover and things like that. And we learned a lot of lessons for the training now when we went through it. But I think from what we knew at the time, we maximized it as best we could in the short time we had to get ready.
So if the prior units were facing maybe one or two of these attacks during their entire rotations, that's not a lot of opportunity to develop sort of combat-tested TTPs, tactics, techniques, and procedures, right? So when, you know, pretty suddenly your units are hit by so many of these attacks, I would imagine that requires a pretty significant degree of adaptability.
Yeah, I think our Army senior leadership transformation and contact from General Randy George, I think it's a pretty good example of that. It's not bragging about it. That's just what it was. When we went over there, we knew whether it's LISCO equipment, you know, there's some stuff with humans you can do and adjust processes, which what you have to do. And then there's some technical things that we learned as we went. And then everything that we touched, because every base is different with different equipment, with different context, and they all have to do it differently. But one of the things we did early on was I was wrong in assuming Al-Asad, one of our bases out in Western Iraq, would not be attacked very much. And the battalion out there under Russ Limler and Major Padalino, I asked them to like be the Project Convergence of Iraq, no better place to test and evaluate things. So from day one, we threw a bunch of stuff. We reached out to Army Research Lab and a lot of other things to, hey, let's find out. But even the equipment we had there, if it said we, you know, it did this, we wanted to know it did it, and we wanted to know everything we could about it. And they very systematically were going through from day one these pieces of equipment and the processes and adjusting it. Now, we didn't have any real-time feedback, but we learned a lot there that spread across the brigade pretty fast. And I still think the idea of using, for a bad analogy, but Project Convergence at Al-Asad was very helpful. And for the Army, we tested lots of other equipment besides counter UAS, but it was very helpful for us.
So the counter UAS equipment that you tested, can you describe that? Once you started facing these attacks, you know, what is the sort of hardware, what are the hardware options you have to identify and defeat incoming UAS?
Yeah, and I think every base is drastically different and has different equipment, but and I'll use Al-Asad because it had the most, right? So I'll start there, and then some of that wasn't at other places. But we think of it as a layered defense, obviously, just like, you know, it's coming from a different through the air, obviously. But as we think about it in layers, the most important part of it is detection. If we know something's coming, and in general, somewhere between 30 seconds and probably 2 minutes, depending on where the location. In general, we could detect something and have 30 seconds to 2 minutes of heads up to either make a decision or get people in a bunker and protect them. So knowing it's coming is number one. I may lose some equipment, but I can keep the people safe. And then for the feed options, as you start out far and come in, and some of them, I mean, there's a plethora of them, but you can start with just, you know, our planes can knock them down if they can find them. So you start way out there. Then as you work your way in from the base, you have kinetic options like the Coyote missile from Raytheon. That was probably our most effective one that we used. That doesn't mean it should be, it's not applicable to other contexts necessarily, but that was very successful. Then going in from there, and these are not just everything we tested, but the base of them. Then Al-Asad also had the DM SHORAD. That is on a Stryker platform that got there near the end of our thing, but we could work that in the system. They had a thing called a PHEL, a laser, essentially. They had two of those different wattages, and we could use that. Once again, not all these worked as well as we thought they would, but we also had it at two of our bases in Iraq, UK systems that were there that were kinetic missile launched at back at it. And then you have things for EW, electronic warfare, things called the FS LIDS, and lots of other different ones that you could try, and testing which ones worked and didn't work. And the last kinetic option that was at most of our bases is the LPWS, which is essentially, a lot of people know it as the CRAM, you know, shoots straight, you know, kinetic rounds, like a rifle, a lot of them very fast, and it tracks it and shuts it down. But out of the 93 out of 115 we shot down, our only successes, and that doesn't mean the other stuff doesn't work, were Coyote missiles, probably number one, LPW in terms of numbers, LPWS, and then the UK system. Those are the three that comprise those 93.
I want to kind of follow up on something you mentioned that, you know, one of the most important things is identification early enough to give yourselves that 30 seconds to 2 minutes of time to take whatever action that you decide to take. And that's about sensors, right? And when we're talking about sensors, you know, I guess I have a personal tendency to kind of contextualize it within within my own experience. Maybe some listeners do the same thing. When I was in East Baghdad on a small FOB in 2008, it seemed like whenever you heard the big voice come on, you know, incoming, 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 nothing was actually incoming. There were no rockets, no mortars, what have you. It also seemed like every time we did get hit by rockets, mortars, whatever, we never heard the alert. And, you know, that's maybe an anecdotal testament to the fact that it's really hard to build effective sensors and integrate them in a way that, you know, you have a high degree of confidence that they're going to see what you want them to see. That's obviously a number of years ago, but, you know, based on your very recent experience, are we continuing to kind of improve in terms of our of the sensors that we employ?
I I think so. I mean, I don't think we tried before, right? Because it wasn't there. But there is a plethora of radars, you know, 5, 6. Do they all talk to each other and do they all feed the right thing? We can talk about a little later. But without question right now, the best radar out there is the KIRST radar made by Raytheon, right? That is, now remember, these are coming in extremely low to the ground. And it does make it hard, but the vast majority, I mean, the success we had is even those systems that engage them, whether electronically, kinetically, they all have to know it's there. And so we shot down 93. That doesn't mean we didn't detect the other ones. The systems didn't work. And it gets very technical why some of those didn't work. But for the most part, I can't think of very few instances where the human operator might have not noticed it at the time, which is going forward some of the things we need to look at and how it needs to get better. You know, that's a soldier at every post 24/7 looking at a screen. And because some of these bases are next to international airports, some of them are next to big cities. As things come on your screen and identifying what's it, you know, detecting it and then identifying what it is and then deciding that it's bad or good takes some time. And if you remember 30 seconds to 2 minutes, that's very fast. And it goes by extremely fast for them. Some places, not to get into the specific numbers, would pick up them at distances just based on terrain and things, and easier to discriminate between friendly and enemy ones coming at us, while other bases had less time, just on the whole. But we could go and fly things around and take the slack out of that, if you will. Know where our gaps, know where the radars, move them, test them, and evaluate them constantly. Is one of the many things that we did to eliminate the risk of one hitting us without us detecting it.
And how much of the process, you know, once there is that initial identification, how much of the process is manual, confirming the identity of what the radar detected, choosing what weapon system to use, communicating details to others that need to be involved? Are there any tools that automate any of that to shorten that process, and not just technology, you know, automated decision-making, the types of things that we often think about, but, you know, standard operating procedures that maybe say, you know, if we detect this combination of speed, altitude, and trajectory, we know we'll employ, you know, system X with another combination, system Y, or is it entirely manual?
The first one, to answer your question, a lot of it is human, and that needs to change, and we know that, and I think the Army's on the right path to that. We're communicating with Army senior leaders, and there are some initiatives, and they see it. Almost the senior leaders visited us over there, and we walked them through some of these. And as you mentioned, there's a couple Nipper articles out there on the call website. We've on the SIPR call website, the secret one. We have put the videos in our products that lay this out a lot clearer in the secret realm. But a lot of it is human. And now, just like anything, I think our time over there, like if I went to, you know, testing a soldier touch point, right, you know, a year ago, and I saw the radar and some of these defeat systems, I'd go out there, I'd see it knocking one drone down, and I'd be like, that's pretty, I wouldn't have great feedback to give because I saw it work. When you start putting reality in there and all the different radars there, how the different systems impact each other and how much human interaction needs to happen to make that decision. You clearly want to shoot with your furthest weapon that can hit it down. You know, so as it gets closer and closer, you're using everything you can, but all those different systems have to spin up at the same time. And a human has to say, you know, shoot, engage, whatever that's as it gets closer. And working that timing out as it's coming is one of those human things that was done.
Yeah, so the human is in the loop for the entire process. Anthony Padolino, I was the X-3 out at Al-Asad Air Base, so forward, and did all of the base defense operations out there and oversaw the BDOC. So the human is going to, you know, the detection system, that's the capability of the radar, so we're on that. But the identification, friend or foe, is absolutely a human operator. When we talk the technical piece, you know, how we were trained to go over there originally was based off visual identification, and that acronym known as WEFT, Wing, Engine, Fuselage, Tail. So when we first started seeing these things, you know, our BDOCs, our Base Defense Operations Centers, were looking for the devices flying. But we found our cameras, you know, they're just not that good if you want to get something, one of those furthest weapon systems out. So we started using, you know, procedural, what we coined as like our digital PID, looking at the physics-based tracks, you know, the bearing, the altitude, the range, the speed, or bars for short of a track, bouncing that off the air tasking order, seeing if it's supposed to be there. Also, so that, you know, that's all a lieutenant and a staff sergeant doing that, or a lieutenant and a sergeant, by the way. So they make that decision, and they have anywhere between, you know, 30 and 60 seconds to identify that track, friend or foe. Or it's probably going to impact on their base. So once that happens, they'll move into their defeat, and that's kind of their battle drill. Well, they'll look at firing up an interceptor, which takes a little bit of time. You know, nothing's instant. Maybe talking on a Stinger or a direct energy piece, and then, you know, maybe that phalanx gun. All the while alerting the base, reporting to higher, and then making sure, because the BDOC, you know, it's the center, the nucleus for everything that happens on a base. Think of it as like your COOPS floor. So counter UAS is like a 4-minute thing that they do. And then the crisis response, the patrols, all that other stuff flows through them. And it's, you know, it's junior leaders, you know, a major, a captain, a colonel isn't deciding whether or not to shoot that thing out of the sky. You know, it's a lieutenant or staff sergeant. And I think that's like the biggest thing when you talk about risk and powering it down. You know, these aren't our air defenders doing it. These are infantrymen, artillerymen, cavalry scouts. So I think that piece, you know, hitting on the process. And then right now, you know, we wrote about it. General Viles got an article out in a Military Review, and it talks about the manual process and some of those challenges and where we need to get to. And I think that's, you know, at least at the operator level, it's frustrating, you know. We don't have automation. We don't have artificial intelligence. We don't have machine learning that can assist, you know, people who don't do this for a living. But, you know, after a while, as you can see, some of our BDOCs got very, very good at it. And the team that assumed the mission from us is doing very well. So probably a long answer to a short question.
No, that's really, really helpful. You know, when we talk in terms of human in the loop versus human on the loop, I think it sometimes implies a binary distinction that isn't necessarily accurate. It's more complicated and nuanced than that, because these are complex processes, right? So it's about finding those places, even relatively small and targeted ones, where some form of automation just speeds things up a little bit, obviously without, you know, without introducing unacceptable levels of risk. You mentioned being able to test a lot of this equipment. I'm curious, you know, when you did so, if you found things that you didn't like, if you found things that you'd like to improve about the way, you know, a particular system works, or even something like its user interface, if you found those things, were you able to make tweaks to those systems?
Yeah, I think to answer that, multi-layered here, there are some things in the software settings and things that, quite frankly, aren't taught. And we learn those through failure and some success, and you get some feedback back and be like, well, what's that? Can I change that? Not to get in the details of what they were, but like there's certain parameters that we didn't know existed. So those are easy fixes, just literally getting the right people. Because remember, some of these are program of record equipment, which is like the Army's, what we say we're buying, and some of them weren't. And some of them were industry, some of them were at some places I know we didn't talk about. We brought some SOCOMs, you know, programs record, which is different than conventional Army, and we could evaluate them side by side so we could see and learn which ones had better, you know, either software updates or capabilities. I think we can all agree, if we grabbed a dry erase board and said, hey, what's the perfect system, you know, like, and defined it by requirements of machine learning, AI, taking the human, you know, more to the fringe of the loop, you know, just deciding. And but what worries me and what we've talked about is we have what we have, and to evolve to where we need to get to go, you know, you got to look at it iteratively. And we've already invested in some areas that create, you know, technical debt, you know, like we're in that, and to change that. But at the end of the day, the system, almost, when you take the defeat, the detect, the software being and the network being open and where pieces of it can come in and out, regardless of who makes it, allows you to get closer to that end state. We've written a lot in the secret article, a little bit more details about what that would look like and what it needs and some of the technical parameters. But in lieu of that, I'm sure on, you know, Storm in Normandy Beach, the people didn't have what they thought they had. So we're always going to take what we have and try to make it better. Right. And that's not just what impressed me about the soldiers and those young officers and NCOs that were doing it out there. We're always going to try to make it better. How do we get it in the Army system to be better? I think we're on the right path, but we've got a long way to go.
I mentioned earlier, having spoken to one of your battalion commanders, Max Ferguson, he and another battalion commander from your brigade, Russ Lemler, wrote an article for MWI about some of these lessons. And in it, they highlighted an example kind of what we're talking about in terms of tweaking systems. They said, you know, one of the radar software packages, the interface was just a little bit cumbersome. And in some cases, the operator needed to click 14 times to toggle through all of the steps and complete whatever action they were doing. They wanted to be able to improve that. You know, but one of the difficult things about high-end equipment of any sort, the type of high-end equipment that we often use in the Army, is that it requires a lot of support, usually contractor support. Presumably that was the case with the systems you've been talking about, and you had contractor support either, you know, physically with you, co-located with you in on these bases, or in a sort of reach back capacity. In terms of that contractor support, did you run into any challenges, you know, when it came to, you know, making tweaks to those systems?
Yes, we did. And we struggled in a couple areas. Some is because some of the systems are non-program of record right now. You know, there's contractors there, and they can do so many things. We are only allowed to do so many things. But what we instilled early was ownership. You know, like if you take the slack out of everything that can go wrong, meaning you're on a static base, you can go look at the wire that's connecting this stuff every day. You can, if a bomb, you know, goes off, you can go check to make sure your still stuff works. But the more we played with it, the more we wanted to verify everything, the angles of everything, the who could load some of these things, which is a contractual problem, you know, some of these systems, and things like that. The thing you described with Anthony is the one that did that evaluation for 14 clicks out at Al-Asad. And that's, once again, and I know it's in the article, but that means to get the Coyote missile out, that guy who's deciding, those young NCOs or officers, as he's going through it, from zero to it launching is somewhere around 14 clicks. There's some context there, but that's too many clicks. And if you get one wrong, as he's in a hurry and he's nervous, quite frankly, it won't go. And some of them aren't needed. So there's little things in the thing, but that is the interface that what they're talking about. That is FADC2, what he's looking at on the screen. And then based on kind of what I talked about with technical debt, what feeds into that, different radars, what feeds out of that to defeat the system, you know, the fire control, whatever that is, and there's plenty of options, that open network to allow any data to come in and go out is what one of the many things long-term that needs to be fixed. Short-term, absolutely what you mentioned with the contractors and the speed. Now, a lot of people in the Army were interested in this when it started happening from the Pentagon and before, rightly so. So I know they understand it, and they're making, once again, we're heading in the right direction. But it's also confusing and who owns it in the Army. And when I'm talking to, you know, double digit people about it, then I'm like, well, who's the person? So there's things we can do on our side too, to make that better.
You know, when we talk about the scale of the threat, the sheer number of attacks that your brigade face makes it, again, as we've said several times, the most relevant experience that the Army has on defending against drone attacks. But as you've alluded to a couple of times, and rightly so, I think, you know, the simple fact is that in large-scale combat operations, there's probably a limit to how applicable some of the lessons we've talked about will be. In Ukraine, for example, and I know this number has been floating around for a while, so maybe it isn't the most updated metric, but at least gives a sense of scale. In Ukraine, both sides, the Russians and Ukrainians, are reported to have been losing up to 10,000 drones each month, losing that many drones each month. What do you think, you know, when we sort of expand out to that, just that sort of scope and scale, what do you think we should be focusing on the most in order to sort of take the lessons your brigade has learned and scale them up, or at least to give us sort of a roadmap toward preparing for an environment with many, many more unmanned systems in the sky?
Yeah, and I would say a couple of things. The first, all of ours were group 2 and 3. So the details matter in the 10,000,
right?
Or were they group 1, small DJI type drones, things like that. So different systems may work. I think that technical debt discussion is extremely relevant here, in the sense that as we develop it for fixed site, if we commit to a system that isn't movable as much and not open and things like that, then we will limit our ability in LISCO. It's very easy early on in October to see a future where there's 10,000 in the air. At most, we had 5 in 1 hour. Now, that's a group 2 coming at one base over an hour, not minutes. So every layer is going to have to get more robust in our system. And then we're going to have to figure out, and this is where the Army is going through right now, well, is it always infantrymen and filler? The whole manning, training, and equipping of this, once we get the technology right, and one won't happen before the other, but how do we evolve into that? And we're providing, Anthony wrote a whole bunch of the training stuff. Most of that was for us, once again, in our context, for the people replacing us. But you can't help but see the carryover in LISCO. But whatever the detect is, the nice thing about LISCO is I'm spread out more in general, right? And even on fixed sites, things like if the detect's important, there are times when our allies, you know, take in Iraq, Erbil is, you know, in the north and it's surrounded by Kurds, which we work with closely. And if they heard it, 100 miles coming, you know, they call and tell us and we get a heads up. So it goes back to, we can increase our ability to detect. And some of that's just going to be, not that it's easier in LISCO. I personally believe that the way I see it right now anyway, and this evolves over time, I don't stop every artillery piece or every artillery shell landing on me right now, especially in a LISCO fight. I won't be able to stop every single one way. Now there's swarms, there's the group 2s and 3s that are one way UAVs, and there's different options and threats. So to narrow it down to just one threat, the one we saw, if you're an enemy, you have to put in a grid and then launch it from, you know, it takes a couple hours to fly towards me in general. As a brigade, not as the Army, not bigger than a brigade, if I'm not at a fixed site in a LISCO environment, then that's very hard to do. And I have offensive options to target your stuff that you're using to find me, right? Now, when you go back to like airports, ports, cities where people may be and things like that, then there absolutely is, at some level, there needs to be a protection with this layered defense to protect very important stuff that's back there. But where that balance is, I think that's the next big decision once the technology gets there for us, of how we man, train, and equip this, quite frankly.
We spent most of the discussion so far talking about kinetic options. How effective were non-kinetic options? You know, were they something that you could rely on?
I think very contextual. So like everything, I think there's this reluctancy for sometimes industry, sometimes specific companies, sometimes the Army. Like when we would evaluate stuff out of Al-Assad, you're like, oh, it doesn't work, so we don't want it. Like that's which is the wrong almost attitude to have. Like many companies, and it doesn't work, they'll make it work. We didn't see on group 2 and 3, we saw one system work one time. You know, but with any EW system, you have 4 risks. You got the risk that it doesn't work, which is which we can find out, right? You got the risk that it impacts your own ability to shoot kinetic options and your equipment. That's another layer, which we did see a few times. You have the risk that it impacts civilian infrastructure, a civilian airliner or things like that. And then a longer term risk of EW is changes at lightning pace. So as they get software updates, my system has to. So just because it works today doesn't mean it's going to work next month against, a changed software. So as long as there's that tooth to tail and that is getting updated and staying with the current threat, then maybe. So I think there is a future for that and for, as we keep looking at directed energy and other technologies out there, we just didn't see them work yet in our experience. Now, I think as we transition to the future, what we need is surrogate drones that replicate exactly that threat without a bomb on them. So, instead of trying them in real time and the mistake of failure is a bomb blowing up on your base, that we can see if it works or not in the safety that comes with, it being our own in evaluation.
Given that you were largely successful defending against most of these drones, did you detect any sort of tactical evolution on the threat side in terms of, how they tried to mask their approach to a base or anything like that?
Absolutely. I think it's hard to know like how coordinated each of them and who was launching them, but in pockets without question, from altitude to speed, using buildings, what approach they came on, varying the altitude as it's coming in and speed. Absolutely. And that's going to continue. That's not just like us. We're not going to stop.
There's a tendency sometimes, I think, to maybe even a temptation to see an emerging threat and to think of solutions to defend against it, principally in terms of technology. But there's obviously more to it than that. We do things across the .mil PF spectrum for a reason. If we talk in, sort of in more abstract terms about the most effective things we can do just to generally be prepared for a future fight that will require us to defend against drones at a very large scale, what do you think are some of the keys to that?
I think where we just philosophical here, right? The more, and this is hard for the Army that likes structure and things like that, but our chances of getting something right is to allow lower elements to experiment a little bit and give them the resources they need to do it, whether that's in how you're organized, whether that's in equipment. When we try to solve it on PowerPoint, and there's a fine balance between this, so I'm not saying we should go to anarchy, but at some point, the more iterations and different ideas that are tried, the better chance of you getting it right. We all know that nobody can predict the next, what war is going to look like exactly, and we'll get it wrong. It's how fast we can adapt once it does start. And I think that if you're trying a lot of different things at once, that's a pretty good, you increase your chances exponentially of getting closer to what we need to go to. And as long as we have a system to see that and adjust to it and get closer to the right answer, God forbid, if it does start, we're in a better position.
I guess I'm making sort of an assumption here, but I assume that when you were a lieutenant, this wasn't something you were giving a lot of thought to, right? Defending against one-way attack UAS, but it's something you had to contend with as a brigade commander. You said this is something that junior leaders, junior officers and NCOs play a major role in. What are sort of some things maybe that we as an Army could be doing or should be doing to ensure that those lieutenants, those sergeants and staff sergeants are prepared not only for the UAS threat, but also for it to continue to evolve?
Yeah, I think most of one, they generally have a leg up on us from my experience as a lieutenant, because they're just better with some of the technology. They grasp things at a rate and provide input that changed the way we do it. Most of some of our products were, E6 writing and making videos and making and shooting down drones. But I think we owe it to them a little bit. But I think the biggest gap probably for me right now, my opinion, is the understanding of electronic warfare and what it means from a tactical targeting perspective, from a radar perspective. And we don't know where it fits in right now. But it's the things you can't see that how you target, how you see detect rate one ways, all that stuff, we don't know where it sits. I had an EW officer here, he just recently left, but even when he was briefing my successor, right, 1 minute when he was in the fires discussion, the other he was in the intel section, and we moved him around, you're like, well, where does he fit? And the answer is all of them, right? So how we grasp that, and how it's almost like, to me, when fires was fires, when I was lieutenant, infantry was infantry, intel was intel, you know, and it was more clean. And now what is an ISR platform today? Is it a fires platform, an aviation platform, an intel platform? And the answer is yes, it's all of them, you know? And so how we develop them, and how we're designed to using your .milpf, and how we look at them, they're in silos. And I know there's efforts to cross-pollinate there, but it's different now. And they inherently get that, the younger officers, quite frankly. What we owe them is a training ecosystem at our post and replicating of this stuff. It's hard to train on this stuff here because we don't have most of the equipment here, very little of it. And that's coming. But so I think we will get there. And I think as long as we push stuff down to them, they will do better than I did as a lieutenant and giving us the right answer, at least one of them.
I'd like to sort of zoom out and ask, you know, the Army at its best is a learning organization, right? And when you have a situation like this where one brigade has experienced something that no other unit in the Army has experienced, at least not at the same scale, it's really important that those lessons are shared, but also that those lessons are, or that we take appropriate actions based on those lessons. I understand that you recently hosted an event at Fort Drum with organizations from around the Army, across the Joint Force, allies and partners, I believe, industry, an event focused on countering UAS. We're doing this podcast so you can share some of the lessons. I know you've encouraged leaders in your brigade to write about what they've learned and share that, both in unclassified venues like MWI and elsewhere, as well as in classified forums on CIPR. How have you sort of found the experience, I guess, you know, is your sense that the systems and processes are in place to share lessons learned in a way that actually does drive change?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, in some, there's just like everything, there's things that we could improve on. But we have written a few Nipper articles. The secret link is on the bottom with. So we try to capture it a place where people could get to it. That's on our thing. At the Army at large, what's good about right now is there's not many times when you write an article that you know the senior leaders in our Army are going to, they're listening and they read it and they're asking questions back. Every brigade, I think, is extremely interested in it. It is hard to explain the technical things and some of the lessons without the equipment, and they don't have it. They can't do it themselves. So, it, you know, institutionally, and they're all busy getting ready for other things, but they all understand it. And other brigades, some from Hawaii, brigade command teams, were here last week at the symposium. The interest is there. Everybody, I think, knows the direction it needs to go. Maybe not all every answer. And some of those answers are in the details that we learned. You know, I've heard some solutions that don't make sense from what we've from our experience, at least, you know, as we develop new things. But it's, I go back to what I said there at the beginning. You don't always know when you write articles or provide feedback that it's going to be read by anybody, quite frankly. And I know right now ours are, and that's not a look at us. That's it gives me faith that the Army is heading in. And I don't know all the answers either, but we provided what we learned.
What about sort of joint sharing of lessons learned across services? You know, at the same time as your brigade was facing these attacks over this period of several months, the Houthis were attacking ships in the Red Sea and the area around Yemen, and the U.S. Navy was involved in responding to that. And there are sometimes, you know, these firewalls that exist between services. We don't try to create them. They're just sort of there as a function of you know, each service's unique missions, responsibilities, and cultures. There are places, however, where there's, I guess, operational overlap, like countering UAS. You know, the CRAM, which we talked about, the Phalanx, had its origins as a shipborne defensive system. I'm curious, you know, have you had any discussions with Navy counterparts or Air Force counterparts? Because, you know, they have a role in this as well, right?
Absolutely. And some of the systems that are on the Navy, the collaborative.
So the Navy's, they actually got a little leg up on, you know, the nuclear powered ships, some of them, right? They can have active sensors and a concept of cooperative engagement, right? Where something can sense and something else can shoot. Our systems, you know, Army based systems that my personal opinion, just working on them at Al-Asad, they were built out of the air defense era. You know, the FADC2, while its great system is performing the job, you know, that first entered defense from the research I found like 1989, right? Which is good, but a sequential process, which again, I got to individually click each track, and then I got to click each interceptor individually. And then if I see something else, I got to go back up. Now, how do I monitor? That's that philosophical discussion of human on the loop, human in the loop. Well, you know, at the end of the article in Miller Review, you know, we kind of lay it out that the human confirms the identity, friend or foe, and then the automation defeats, right? So we can watch that process. And that's essentially what the Phalanx weapon system does in the Navy. Now, the Navy's got some other equipment that's a lot more expensive than what we have. But our stuff's also like closed networks, right? So it's very hard, you know, you have to like understand how fire control radars work and what that does in the, when we talk technical debt to open the aperture for other industry radars, like, you know, you run into proprietary data issues, you know, collaborations companies. So that's kind of what we saw at our bases. But we did speak with the, you know, other services and what they were doing, but, you know, it was a different threat. You get to that UAV, UAS threat too. Different systems that we've seen in different locations as well.
And John, I think just to add on to answer your question, I mean, I wasn't talking to the head of the Navy, but many of the organizations are joint. The Joint Counter U.S. Office, Joint Counter U.S. University, and some of our partners, the U.K. partners and things like that, a lot of those were shared. There's clearly some firewalls built in there where what we can and can't share to even our partners. And some of those we had to knock down, quite frankly, just to get those lessons out, because they've got some good stuff too. And they may come up with a better answer than we will.
Well, before we wrap up and maybe to close out the discussion, I kind of want to open it up and ask, you know, you've been back now for a couple of months from this deployment, during which, you know, this experience defending against drone attacks at this scale was a fundamentally unique one in the Army. Are there any other sort of major reflections that you'd like to share with listeners?
I think the most fascinating thing for me, John, was this is a different deployment than any of the other ones I've been on. And one of the lots of reasons, but probably one of the biggest ones, is it's all contextual there. This is not a political statement of what we should and shouldn't do. This is it was almost like we were being hunted versus hunting, right? And that psychologically is different. Now, one of the many things what I found with counter UAS is as you're giving people something to solve, it provided like some agency, you know, like when you know you have something and you're working and the outcome depends on the work you put into it. Because psychologically, that warfare is different and tough. I mean, it is a. I've been over there once or twice, and it was amazing to watch the brigade soldiers, one, go past the cursory understanding of their equipment, two, innovate with it and solve crazy problems, and then just win the daily fight in the mirror with themselves and like do the right thing. 270 days, not a day off. Sitting there watching this stuff, and that's why we had the success we have. Hopefully some of those translate into a better Army that can better defend itself.
Well, I think we will leave it here. I want to thank you again for taking some time to share your perspective on the subject, to talk about your brigade's experience and discuss some of the lessons from that experience, because it is really important. So thank you very much.
Yeah, anytime.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing before you go. If you aren't yet following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.